tejasvinavadhitamastumavidvishabahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Om Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shiva Sadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna 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 Hare Hare. Hare Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare.
Mantra 17 confirms that the living entity continues to exist after the annihilation of his material body. The soul does not die when the gross body is destroyed, as the materialists think, nor is it obliterated when the subtle body is dissolved as a result of spiritual practice, as the Mayavadis speculate. The soul has an eternal individual existence. The spiritual knowledge reaches maturity when one realizes the soul is not only eternal, but is an eternal part and parcel of the Supreme Lord. Without such understanding, there will be fall down, even from Brahmajyoti. Because Brahmajyoti is not the natural position of the living entity. So, therefore, even when one gets to the Brahman platform, one can't stay there, because the living entity is Brahman in relationship to the Supreme Lord. Right? They're discussing that the Lord is eternally manifest in four features, right? The Lord means himself, his internal potency, the jivas, and the external potency, right? So, and these four, he's always present. So that would mean is that the living entity can only establish himself in the internal potency if he understands that he is servant of the Lord. Right? Otherwise, to stay in the Brahman platform won't be practical because there's no activity. Because Brahman is simply the effulgence of the spiritual platform. Right? So then that would mean he would then be situated in the material. Because their activity is then addressed. The living entity, being an individual person, then has needs. And those needs need to be fulfilled. And so either they're fulfilled on the spiritual platform or they're fulfilled in the material platform, depending upon the identity. So, but the spiritual identity is I am servant of Krishna. Material identity is I'm not servant of Krishna. So even if one gets to the Brahman platform, then one can't stay there. He'll have to come back to the mundane world to perform activities. Right? Because his consciousness is not at I am servant of Krishna. So that's why then it's considered maturity that one understands I am servant of Krishna. That's the important element. In order to remember the Lord at the time of death, one should practice the nine processes of devotional service throughout his life. Quote, unless one is accustomed to devotional practice, what will he remember at the time of death? When the body is dislocated, how can he pray to the Almighty Lord to remember his sacrifices? Sacrifice means denying the interests of the senses. One has to learn this art by employing the senses in the service of the Lord during one's lifetime. One can utilize the results of such practice at the time of death. So Krishna is making the point is that wherever you're going to go from this body, it's all determined at the time of death, what you're thinking of, what you're absorbed in. So if one can control the senses, engage the senses properly, then in Krishna's service, then that's naturally going to be the focus. Right? Because one is going to take shelter of whatever physically or emotionally one finds connection with, some pleasure with, some happiness with, some identity with. So if one's practice has been engaging the senses separate from the Lord, then that's going to make it more difficult at the time of death, because then you have more options other than Krishna to take shelter of. Right? But if the senses are always controlled and engaged in the Lord's service, So here, denying the interest of the senses. That means the interest of the sense is to meet the sense object. Right? But the point is where's Krishna in that? So it doesn't mean that the sense and sense object can't meet, but where's Krishna in it? Krishna has to be part of that. Right? I just want to eat something. The tongue wants to taste something. That is then the interest of the sense. But to eat prasadam, to honor prasadam, the same sense is being engaged, but Krishna is connected. Right? So we always have to see Krishna is involved. So if Krishna is involved in everything we do, then the common element in our life is Krishna. So at the time of death, then we can think of Krishna. Does that make sense? Because here he's praying to remember his sacrifices. So how will he remember that? He'll be so absorbed in something else. Mantra 17 is a prayer that the Lord remembers all sacrifices done for him and accepts them as devotional service. As Vedanta Deshika explains, the devotee prays that the Lord carry what the devotee lacks and preserve what the devotee has. Bhagavad Gita 9:22. In other words, what you've done for Krishna, you're praying that Krishna will accept them as service to him. Right? There's been sacrifice. You've done an activity. You've given up your own particular interest for the interest of Krishna. Let's take it back. You're giving up your own interests. But you want to see that giving up of your own interest is in connection with Krishna. Does that make sense? Because we know it's not good. So because it's like when we hear the interest of the senses. Sacrifice means denying the interest of the senses. And then one has to learn this art by employing the senses in the service of the Lord during one's lifetime. But generally when we hear this, we will catch this first part, that it means not engaging the senses. Denying the interest of the senses means not engaging them at all. Right? So then, but that's only half of it. We're denying the interest of the senses means we're engaging them only in the Lord's service. Right? So then we may be performing sacrifice of giving something up for a higher purpose, but we have to make sure that we've made that connection that higher purpose is Krishna. You understand? So that's why then the devotee is praying that they be accepted as service to him, that they were being done for him. Right? So even if it's done afterwards, still that works. If it's done at the time, it's better. Right? Because that's naishkarmya, that's sannyas. If it's done afterwards, that's renunciation. Right? So it both works, but then always it's... Yeah. But always we have to take it to the point of its connection to Krishna. That's the most important element. Does that make sense? Yeah? Balade Vidyabhushana renders the words krato smara as, O mind, which has will power, remember which is worthy of remembering since death is approaching. Okay. So in other words, mind having willpower, these willpower means the ability to get something done or enact, how you say, enact, not sure of the word, but to bring something to the point of action, right? Because the mind is thinking, feeling, and willing. This is what it does. So willing means action will be performed. Right? So willpower means that ability to bring it to action. Right? So it's the mind that does that, not the intelligence, right? Not the senses themselves. Not anything. It's the mind. So that's why it's so central, it's so important. So this mind having this ability, then Baladev Vidyabhushan is pointing out that is, then we are basically discussing with the mind that it should use its willpower for something that's useful. In other words, we can will to do so many things, but if the mind is willing that the senses are always engaged in the Lord's service, then all of our actions, which means engaging the senses, will be connected to Krishna. Right? Is that what you're saying? So this point then is then the mind being so central, that's the one that we're trying to address. We're trying to catch the mind. Everything else, we're using the intelligence to guide the mind. We're doing all these things so that the mind will happily engage itself appropriately, right? According to one's natural situation. Is that okay? As explained in Bhagavad Gita, the mind can be the best friend or the worst enemy of the conditioned soul. Therefore, it is of vital importance to keep the mind flooded with Krishna consciousness. The state of mind at the time of death will determine the soul's next destination. This is explained in Bhagavad Gita. Whatever state of being one remembers when he quits his body, O son of Kunti, that state he will attain without fail. It says without fail. That's why Krishna says, remembering him alone, right? It's not, means we've been engaged in this process of the senses, sense objects, connecting it to Krishna, right? So Krishna's involved, so therefore the engagement of the senses and the sense objects is being purified. And we are becoming engaged in service because of engaging the senses and sense objects in the Lord's service. But at the time of death, it's thinking of Krishna alone. Because the senses and sense objects are not going to give us shelter. The only benefit was their connection to Krishna. So therefore, at the time of death, it's remembering just Krishna. Leave the other things out. Right? So we've engaged the family in Krishna's service. But it can't be the family in Krishna. This guy has to be Krishna. We may have our position, right? And that's being engaged in Krishna, but it's not position in Krishna, it's only Krishna, or wealth, or whatever may be that's important to us, it has to be just Krishna. Because then you go to Krishna. Otherwise, if you think of Krishna and engaging the senses, then one will come back and be able to be a nice devotee who nicely engages his senses in Krishna's service. Right? Does that make sense? But one will have to do that here. Like that. But the point is why do that here if you can do it there? You know what I'm saying? If you're going to come here by a plan. Don't come here because we can't exclusively think of Krishna. Does that make sense? The acharyas come here because of a plan. Right? So it's not a problem coming here to preach. But why not be on, you know, the highest platform to come here and preach, rather than you're here just because you can't get out of here. You know what I'm saying? Like that. Since you're here, do some preaching. But the idea is that if you're so worried, no, we have to stay and preach. So then perfect yourself, come back. You know, the material world's not going away. You don't have to worry about that. Oh, I missed it, right? You know, no, it's still here. It's going to be here. You know, like that. So that's not a problem. Right? Yes. Generally is because that performance is not his desire, so then it's agyata sukriti. But it's bhakti agyata sukriti. So then depending upon the volume that was obtained, that will bring him in contact with devotional service, actual practical, practicing devotional service. So depending upon the position, then they may, because all these things are very pious and all that, then it will clear so many things, they may be elevated to the heavenly planets or some other thing, or just immediately come into human birth and then get an opportunity to come in contact with Krishna, all these different things. So it would very much probably be individual. But in any case, the final conclusion is they will be put in a position to take up devotional service as a serious practice, like that. So then it's good. There's no loss. Okay. Does that make sense? Yes.
How much does the element of free will determine our result? Like for instance, in preaching, certain movements they just have established. Okay, we got 1 million members. Every member has to buy 50 magazines a month and distribute them. So in this way, every month, 50 million magazines are distributed. And we could set up policies in the same way in our movement. I mean, there have been thoughts like that. And in the past, it was pretty much like that. That if you joined, there was just Harinam and Sankirtan, and there wasn't much else going on. Mm-hmm. Now there is so much else going on, and not so much Harinam and Sankirtan. So, but then again, you always wonder, well, how much is the benefit of a person who engages in the activity just because there is nothing else to do, and the person who actually has options but chooses this as an option? Is there a difference, or because the activity in and of itself is absolute, it doesn't really matter whether you are doing it just because you have to do it? I mean...
Yeah, technically, basically you could say the results are the same. Because it's connected to Krishna, you'll always get benefit. But it's said that the more conscious you are of the benefits and its connection to Krishna, the more benefit you'll get. So, in other words, that there's not much else just means that you're starting from essence, and then it expands from there. So it's supposed to be that you have the essential principles in place. And therefore, the process, the lifestyle, the understanding is very simple also. But that simplicity is based on, you know, the eternal primary principles of Krishna consciousness and its execution. So then the person gets full benefit. Because the point is to obtain the principle. Right? As time goes, people are developed, there's more broad range of you know, interests and mentalities. One is able to expand the preaching to include a broader range of persons. Then, naturally, the whole process can become more sophisticated, but it's still based on those same original principles. Then it's non-different. One won't feel it's different, whether it was, you know, just a bunch of, you know, few devotees in a, you know, an empty rented house in the worst part of town, and the only furniture is, you know, the altar, the seat, Prabhupada's Vyasasan, and the temple president's desk. Then, you know, it's fine, because the principle was everything's connected to Krishna. Now, if you have a very nice, elaborate, fancy temple and all that, but everything's connected to Krishna, then the feeling will be the same. The feeling will be the same. So, but it's very important to note that simple doesn't mean that it's not the main thing. Right? A lot of times it's thought that simple is not so important, more complex is. The expert likes more complex. The neophyte and the master, they like it simple. Right? So the difficulty comes is that when expertise is being, means one should be expert, but more important is mastery. But when expertise is projected more, then the tendency is complexity becomes more favored.
Yes. Usually in complexity and in complexity and in comfort, then the urgency is a lot of times not there, because one is just comfortable.
When's going to, but the urgency may change, because, I mean, it can, but generally if things are complex, then there's always something more to go wrong. So then the tendency is just to deal with what's going wrong with, rather than propagating what's right, you know? So troubleshooting and all that becomes the prominent. But that's why it's so important to keep the connection with the principle. What's the root? Because then, no matter how sophisticated it is, it's the same thing. Before, you go out on the street, it's Hari Nam, you distribute some magazines. But now, if you're distributing a book, it's the same kind of thing. So you may be with the Hari Nam, maybe not, but it's still the same principle of distributing the Lord's name, form, qualities, and pastimes. You know, or you may do something special, you preach in prisons. So, but it's still, you're giving the same thing, the name, form, qualities, and pastimes. You're preaching at the yoga studios. It's still name, form, qualities, and pastimes. You know, it's not that, it's just that, oh, if it's just if they're engaged in pious activities, then it's nice. Because we many times think that, okay, being vegetarian and doing all these kind of Indian kind of stuff or Vedic stuff, we came in contact of that in Krishna consciousness. Therefore, those things are Krishna conscious. No, they are for us because we've engaged them, connected in Krishna. But the karmis haven't necessarily done that. But they may be pious. They may be like vegetarian. They like some oriental philosophy. They like a, you know, some mantras or some incense, you know, or dim lights or candles and, you know, whatever it is. But that doesn't make it spiritual. It just makes it, you know, more of a pleasant environment, maybe more of a sattvic environment. But sometimes devotees may be distracted from the actual essential points and think that, well, actually I'm benefiting these people by just discussing vegetarianism and not actually connecting that to Krishna, you know, or being nice, or, you know, in other words, encouraging the whole New Age movement without connecting it to Krishna. Yes.
So in other words, what you're saying is that the intensity and the success of our preaching depends on how much we can connect all these activities to Krishna in a very direct way.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, so, yes, that's what we're doing. We may use language that is more understandable. We may use examples that may be more understandable to the particular group of persons we're talking to. But what we're preaching is exactly the same. That never needs to be changed. If one says one has to change it, that means one doesn't actually understand the essence. Like that. Otherwise, one is saying, okay, we talk like this, these people won't understand it, so we have to talk like that. But the point is this is the principle, this is how you can apply it to devotees. This is the principle, this is how you explain it to those who aren't devotees.
So the same people who are going to say that you can't distribute Prabhupada's books because Prabhupada says women are inferior or less intelligent and this and that, so we need to write other books.
And so these persons are coming forward with these new books?
I don't think the people who would say that
could write the books, because their interest is not actually writing a book or distributing it. Their interest is bile secretion that creates some purpose in life to that, basically. That's all. But I mean saying, but hey, that's why, you know, all these TV channels have soap operas, is to create that for you. So, you know, hey, rather than take this up and do that, watch some soap operas. You know, you'll get the same benefit. Leave Prabhupada's books alone, you know. So, yes.
I've heard that one devotee was telling me that the whole Krishna consciousness movement is based on Sanskrit, in the sense that
based on Sanskrit.
Without Sanskrit, it would be difficult to propagate.
It would be difficult to propagate.
Does not have a basis. And I was thinking that we have the holy name.
So in the beginning, there was Sanskrit, and it was good. Right? Is that how it works?
Well, we have a Hare Krishna mantra, right?
Okay, and so that's Sanskrit. What is Sanskrit?
A language.
A language, okay. Okay, and this language is based on what?
Sound vibration.
Okay, now when we have the word tree, or vriksha, which means that which will be cut down, right? So the word generates the tree, or there's the tree and then we have the word? course, in the beginning there was the Word, right? Okay, so then,
with other languages, what you're saying is...
Or you said Hare Krishna, so Krishna and his name are non-different, so they go together.
Yeah.
Okay, so is therefore the... what is the Maha Mantra the expansion or servant of Sanskrit grammar, or Sanskrit grammar is there to explain the Maha Mantra?
The latter.
Okay, so then the essential point is chanting the holy name. That is the basis of our movement. Then in that, so we then have our philosophy, right? The Paravidya. Now to explain that, then generally you have to connect it to something that the living entity, the conditioned soul, can relate to, right? So therefore in the Vedas, there are 13 books. There's 14 books total, but one is the Transcendental Law. 13 books deal with the material energy, right? So then the idea is that you give examples and perspectives according to one of those, or any combination, whatever works. So Sanskrit is one of them. So to a grammarian, then that's very good. But if you'll notice, how much grammatical explanation do you see in our purports?
Very little.
Very little. But now if you look back into the original commentaries written by the Acharyas, how much is there?
A lot.
A lot. So why isn't that being used?
It's not appropriate.
Why isn't it appropriate? No one understands it. Why? Because they speak English, which doesn't have a grammar. You know what I'm saying? In other words, English is there as a spoken language. And grammarians apply the grammar onto it as it's being spoken today. Right? A dictionary doesn't define a word. A dictionary defines how it's being used today. You understand? In other words, it's backwards. Sanskrit, there's a grammar, then there's the language. English, there's a language, then there's a grammar. You know what I'm saying? It's a borrowed language, so therefore it's borrowed grammar. Does that make sense? So because of this, grammatical explanations don't make sense. Otherwise, grammatical explanations are a kind of logic. So they're used in the scriptures, in the commentaries, very greatly, something like that, because grammatical positions are very fixed, but in English grammar they're not. How do you define one thing? A noun they can say, a verb they can say, but after that they don't really have good definitions. So each one's based on the other one, based on the next, and so unless you've studied all of them together, and after a while some people understand it, but I would say very few do, you know? Enough to make it work, but not really understand. Or they'll say, oh no, it's like this, but why it's like this, that they can't say. Right? But in the Sanskrit, it's very fixed exactly what something does. It's very clear. So therefore, because of that, and language is the medium for, I mean, it's how you say, it's one of the mediums of expression of, you know, rasa and tattva, that is, you know, useful for the human being, right? I mean, we're not so worried about the animal languages or that. But the point is, language expresses that which is understood and experienced and performed by us, right? So that means it's our complete world, our perspective, it's whatever we can understand, right? So that means it has the ability to explain anything within the context of our understanding. So through grammar, you could explain anything. Right? Then poetics means how you nicely apply it so that it's sweet and it's nice, it's attractive, it's interesting, all those things. But grammatical is technical. So therefore, you can say, means it's just like the jiva's position is that of instrumental case. Right? Means the subject applies the verb on the object, right? But the actual point of interaction is that of the verb. not the data, the result. Right? So the verb is actually the central feature that brings together the subject and the object. Right? And so the experience of that verb, that's actually the main point. Not the dative, not the result. Materialists put it on the result. But those who understand rasa knows it's the experience gained from when the verb is applied. Right? Now when you apply the verb, then you do that with instruments. So the jiva can be an instrument in Krishna's interaction between him and his creation. Right? And so, in other words, Krishna is performing an action in relation to a devotee. That's already going to have a taste. But depending upon the instrument, you can add to that taste. So the jiva can add to a taste that's already happening. The jiva never is the taste. The jiva is never the one who is enjoying it or controlling it. But at the same time, as the instrument is the one that does the activity. So it looks like they're doing. So that's the mistake. We're the instrument here, just as much as we're the instrument of the spiritual, we're the instrument here. We never actually are doing anything. But we are taking part in activities that are already going on. You know what I'm saying? The Lord's energies are already interacting. The primary creation has already been done. All the energies are there and related to each other and acting with each other. We in the secondary creation want to take part in that. So therefore, by our desire, then Paramatma approving, then through the modes of nature, we're put in the situation, which is therefore the situation in which the verb is, the locative in which the verb is going to be applied. Right? Then we're able to take part in the activity. But the mistake is when the instrument thinks they're the subject, right? And the object is there for their enjoyment, and the dative therefore is theirs, then you have a problem. Right? Does that make sense?
So how is that related to the Sanskrit?
good joke, yeah. This is why this is not used so much. Because what why I was just explaining to you was Sanskrit grammar. That's what makes Sanskrit so clear and clean, is this point. All other languages are connected back to this in reality, but how clear is this connection? Some languages it's more clear, some languages it's a lot less clear. And so English is one of the ones that's a lot less clear. So therefore, being able to explain it through language is very, very easy and straightforward. It's one of the easiest ways to explain our philosophy. But grammar doesn't mean generally anything to anybody. Like this group, I mean, much of this group means either you have come from a language and know the language that is not English, and you know the grammar, so you understand these points that I'm talking about. You know, or you've been in this class for some time and you're used to this. Otherwise, if I just went into a general assembly of devotees and started talking like this, no one would probably understand anything. I remember there was a group of devotees who had been regularly listening to the classes. We did a program. And I gave an example like this according to grammar. Everybody in there understood. There was a devotee PhD in that audience. They didn't understand what I was talking about, because they had a different concept of what language is. And so then you had to go and give extra explanation to them to be able to understand it. Does that make sense? So the point is, the Sanskrit is great, but how are you? It is one tool that you can use. If you're going to base your preaching purely on that, then you're going to have a difficulty. Because how many people can you discuss grammar with? You know what I'm saying? If they specialized in language, you can do. if they went to a very good university that demanded a very high quality of English expression, then you could also discuss it with them, like that. Or if they're coming from some other, you know, language other than English, then if they're educated in that, you could explain it that way. You understand? So that's the difficulty. If you're taking it that by knowing Sanskrit, then you have the access to the Vedic literature, so for our own understanding, then it's very important. Yes, that is there. Prabhupada says, of all academics, Sanskrit's the most important. Like that. You know, we're sorry for... We upset anybody else who thought, you know, English or math or history was more important. But Prabhupada says Sanskrit. You know, because if you understand Sanskrit, based technically, you understand human life, how to connect it to Krishna. You understand English, basically you don't know zip how to be a human being. You know what I'm saying? In other words, you can learn English nicely and still have no idea how to be a devotee of Krishna. But if you learn Sanskrit according to Jiva Goswami, then not only will you know language, but you'll know how to connect yourself to Krishna. So it's in that way, it's the most important of all academic subjects. Right? Then there's philosophy. Is that okay? Is that, could you get it, put it into perspective? Yes.
But there are many spiritual vibrations that are produced.
There are many spiritual vibrations.
Which are produced by Sanskrit.
They're not produced by Sanskrit. Sanskrit defines what's being produced. you understand? Is Krishna, there's only one truth, right? And that's Krishna. So then this one truth can be described from so many different angles. Does that make sense? So, therefore, Sanskrit is one of them. Because right now we're talking in English, so where's the Sanskrit? But we're using language, so it's one of the ways of dealing. But it's the language of words. What about, you know, the Vedic, you know, drama and dancing or music? That's also language. But it's using something else. You know what I'm saying? You have ritual. That's also a language. So, in other words, that communication, that interaction, that's essential. But, so, the Sanskrit is one of the mediums. But it's the common medium for, documenting all of them. Right? So it's the common language that all other languages expand from. But it's still, a language is an expression of something that's already existing. So in one sense, because it's coming from Krishna, it's non-different. But at the same time, Krishna still is independent of that. So the holy name is independent. You know grammar, you don't know grammar, so it's not that. So it's sound vibration. So it's sound vibration that's the important thing. The grammar defines the sound vibration. You understand? Like that. So you've ran into a grammarian. What if you run into an Ayurvedic, like someone who's in Ayurveda? You don't have health, you don't have life, how are you going to talk Sanskrit? If you're dead, how do you talk Sanskrit? You know what I'm saying? Like that. So that's the wonderfulness of the various Vedic literatures, that whoever's in one of them thinks that everything else revolves around it. You know what I'm saying? So that's the whole point. And in any case, what are you going to do with it? What is the final result of knowing the grammar? Just knowing grammar? Sitting around and crunching words, taking them apart, putting them back together. Right? Sometimes in South, when the puja brahmins are like that, are sitting around waiting for the puja to happen, right? You know, they're doing something, they're waiting for the yajurman to show up, or, you know, the bride to show up, you know, or something like that. They sit around and then for fun they just take verses, you know, common verses that they know. And then because the language and the etymology of the words and the synonyms for the words are so many, then they take them and they play with them for fun. You know, that's what they do. You know, so then they make amusing translations out of them that are technically correct. You know, like one, they take this, like one says this verse about Ganesh, and in it, it uses these different things of something white, you know, I think what it's talking about is rat, and, you know, something that, you know, is coming, and you become very happy. In other words, Ganesh, you know, who's riding on his, you know, his carrier, then makes the world happy, basically, you know, because he removes all the obstacles, right? But they're taking these, and by the words that are used by poetics, they're breaking them apart and putting them back together and doing all this stuff. So one of them is saying, well, actually it's when you see the dobi coming, right? Because he has the donkey, you know, and the big pile of, you know, that, you know, like, tie it up in a big white cloth. So when you see the dobi coming, then you're very happy because then all your anxieties of not having anything to wear go away, right? You understand? Then another one is saying, no, that's a, but it's when you see the daiwata. You know, it's then covered with the white yogurt and all that, spices, and that, you know, relieves your anxiety of hunger. Yeah, and they just go on like this. You know what I'm saying? So the point is it's taking and describing something. Right? So, but the point is it's about actually about Ganesh. But the point is it's about removing the obstacles of the world. So who is it that by being in contact with all obstacles anywhere in the creation go away? It's Krishna. So it's simply describing that. You understand? So it has its place. So you don't want to overbalance something. In other words, know its context. So to be able to understand and explain things, then understanding the grammar, the more you understand, the more clear you know how the words are being used. You know what I'm saying? That's how Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur could speak so eloquently, because he understands language and what is to be expressed. And then he uses all these nice words. Srila Prabhupada is the same thing, but he would do the opposite. He would use the simplest words, but with the same import, the same depth. That's why every time you read it, something new is there, even though the word is so simple. Right? Does that make sense? So you have to be able to understand there's a balance in these things. Otherwise, then there'll be a problem. You overemphasize something, and then you know, then in the sophistication, then we tend to forget the essentials. You know, as was his point before. So all these things are nice. Prabhupada wanted them developed, but not at the expense of the essence. Right? The essential point is Krishna. The paravidya is the essential point. You can expand all you like into the aparavidya, as long as it's connected to the paravidya. But as soon as it becomes disconnected, it's useless. Right? Because otherwise there's tons of Sanskritists, and they're not devotees. Right? They're not devotees. Does that make sense?
Even the Sanskrit used to converse in the spiritual world. That is basically the essential thing, is the rasa, the relationship.
Yeah, it's there to express rasa. But the point is why is it there? Why do you have that variety? It's not just to technically explain something. Nectar devotion has that whole pastime. It's called, it means you have this aspect called chala. It's one of the varieties, I think the 18 varieties within logic, nyaya. So in applying the grammar, then they're using nyaya, right? Because grammar is a logic, and logic is a logic, right? So then, they're using this element chala, which means that you change the meaning of the word. You want to win an argument, then you change the meaning of the word they say, you know? So say, you know, somebody says, yes, we have to be tolerant. And so that's the whole thing is, you know, we must be broad-minded and all these different things like this. The other person then takes the word tolerant and redefines it. You know, so this tolerance means we let anything go on, we just let people do something and completely destroy everything. You know, so you completely can't change the context of it. So you take their words and use them against them. In other words, their strength is their words are being used in a particular way. You change the meaning of how what their words mean, or the context of it. You change their whole presentation. You understand? So chala then in logic is very much used. Right? So that's for those in the mode of passion who use it for debating. Right? Like that. Or if you're preaching, you may have to use it also. You see many times in like Prabhupada in the BTG, Prabhupada speaks out. So many times he just takes a word they take and then gives it, redefines it in Krishna consciousness, and then their whole argument's gone. Right? So then Krishna is with Radharani, like that. And so then she gives a word. She asks him, something about his vasa, I think, which means his residence, or how, in other words, how did he, like this, but it has many meanings. So then he takes it as means she meant, how was your night? In other words, did you sleep well? And, did your evening go nice? And then he takes it and changes it to mean vasa, means residence. And he says, oh, my residence is in your eyes. And then she says, no, I didn't mean that. I asked, how is your night? And then I forget what was the next one. Then he changed it again and into something else romantic connected to her. And so then she changed the word, into something more specific about night. And then he took the word and how it was saying is one word and broke it. And then saying that he was stolen by the night, So he say, no, I wasn't stolen by the night. I was very safe, like this. So in this way, he just constantly plays with the words. So chala is very, very much used in Braj. So the whole point is, but what's that? Is that grammar? No, grammar is the, technical basis on which you would do something. But it's what you're doing is what becomes important. So grammar is only a support. We have to remember it is a Ved Anga. It's not the Veda. Right? It's not Vedanta. So it's always supportive. It's never prominent. What I'm saying? So grammar, if it's not getting across understanding or expression of relationship, then it actually has no meaning. It's useless. Grammar on its own doesn't have any standing. Grammar being useful for expression of knowledge, sambandhi jnana and rasa, that's useful. So if you more you know it nicely, the more you can explain it. Does that make sense? Okay. In Mantra 18, the devotee prays to be freed from the sinful reactions. In Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna promises, Aham tvam sarva pape bhyo moksha ishyami. I will deliver you from all sins. The devotee prays to be freed of sin because this will clear his way back to Godhead. So, as we discussed before, there's two aspects of sin. There's the tendency towards performing sinful activity. So that's something definitely to be controlled. So Pancharatra is very essential in that. You have the element of the sin of leaving Krishna out of it. We want to be the controller and enjoyer so we don't see Krishna in it. So both these are connected. Right? Both these bring about fear because there's lack of relationship with Krishna. So whether it's pious or impious, if it's not connected to Krishna, it's sin. So the point is that what keeps us away from Krishna. Right? Because of not involving Krishna in it, that's why then we forget him, and why the going back to Godhead becomes encumbered. Right? Another aspect of Mantra 18 is explained by Srila Prabhupada in his purport. In this mantra of Sri Isha Upanishad, the devotee prays to the Lord to rectify him from within his heart. To err is human. A conditioned soul is very often apt to commit mistakes. And the only remedial measure to take against such unintentional sins is to give oneself up to the lotus feet of the Lord, so that he may guide one to avoid such pitfalls. Right? So, it's understood the conditioned soul is going to make mistake. If we work on that principle, then the focus will be on the solution, right? Not on punishment. If we take it that the soul is always good and nice, so if he does something wrong, he has to be punished, it won't be progressive. But that the soul will make mistakes because they're conditioned, and that's very unfortunate, and it always makes trouble for him. So therefore, how to correct that? So that correction then is done, is that we surrender ourselves to the Lord and pray for His mercy that we'll be able to overcome these misunderstandings. That make sense? Then it becomes dynamic, because otherwise it's a very different perspective. Very different perspective. If you take it that mistake is normal, but it's not desirable, right? Mistakes in this material world are normal, they're natural, it happens, but it's not in any way desirable. The idea is to come to the perfect platform where one doesn't make such mistakes. Right? That's what one wants. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So this ends here. Today is what? Thursday, yes, okay. So we should be able to finish this tomorrow. And then that'll finish, chronological study of the Ishvapanishad. Then after the festival, when we start up again, then means to keep in contact with Shanti Parayana. So then it's generally either the first Monday or Thursday after Gaur Purnima, as long as there's a few days in between that. Does that make sense? So if Gaur Purnima is like, you know, Saturday or Sunday, then we'd start on Thursday. You know, if Gaur Purnima is on Wednesday, we would start on Monday. Does that make sense? So as it gets closer to the time, then everyone can check when it starts. And then we'll do the analytical study of the Ishvapanishad. In other words, there's so many adhikaranas or points being made here in Ishvapanishad. But now it's a discussion. And so then it's going through in a logical presentation, right? But then you have to build one thing on another thing on another thing. So we see it's giving the one platform and going through. But then giving more depth of understanding of the same principle. So it's all about the Ishvashu principle. So then how to, you know, get to that full depth. Now once one has gone through the whole book, one understands all the points. And one is clear because one's chronologically studied it, all the elements have been brought up, their contexts have been established. So now you can study it by theme. Does that make sense? Because before in the theme, though it's the same point, you get part of it here or one aspect of it here, another part, another, like this. But then you can study all those parts together in one place. That gives you a deeper understanding because in the context, you use a specific context, you define things in a certain way, explaining in a certain way, it makes sense. But sometimes the context of the one and the context of another seem like they're two different points, but they're the same point. As long as they're two different points, we don't see any contradiction. We understand they're the same point, we may think there's contradiction. Okay? Does that make sense? So therefore then, the thematic study becomes very essential. Because without it, then you don't get necessarily the broadest understanding or the depth of understanding like that. So Prabhupada says, one must read and one must study the books. So reading means chronological. Study means making connections. Does that make sense? So that's what we'll do after Gaur Purnima. We'll start with that. And then we finish Ishvapanishad, then we'll go into Gita, doing the same thing, chronological study, then analytical study. Okay.
So. Om Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Krishna Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Srila Prabhupada ki, Samavetaya Bhaktivinoda ki, Jai Nitai Gaura Premananda.
Coming here, then just mention that, if they feel like giving some.
Okay.